The following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Okay, now, before we go on to marriage and family, just wondering, somebody had asked me about yarmulkes, right? The idea of a yarmulke. So very briefly, because it's not on the syllabus and it's something that's pretty fundamental. The yarmulke is probably the most overt external symbol of our Judaism, right? Somebody sees you on the street with your yarmulke, right? There's no mistake. Either that or they think you're the Pope. But generally, they know that you're Jewish if they see the yarmulke. Now, the yarmulke was a tradition. It began as a custom, which with time, it evolved. Eventually, it became a binding mitzvah, and it appears in Shulchan Aruch. The halacha in Shulchan Aruch says that a person is not allowed to walk 4 cubits. 4 cubits is approximately 6 feet. Is not allowed to walk 6 feet without having a yarmulke on, or sit with his head exposed for the amount of time it would take him to walk 6 feet. That's what the law says in the Shulchan Aruch. The yarmulke is that it's a constant reminder to us that there is somebody above us. And the word yarmulke comes from the Aramaic, Yare Malka, fear of the king. Yarmulke is Yare Malka, fear of the king. The yarmulke reminds us that there's somebody above us. It's called, in modern Hebrew, it's called a kippah. A kippah is a dome, right? That's shaped like a dome. Some people call it the yid lid, right? You can revert it that way, right? And the truth of the matter is, it doesn't matter what your yarmulke, what type of yarmulke you wear. Some people wear that, unfortunately, in Israel especially, the yarmulke has come to mean certain stereotyping. If you wear a big, black, furry one, right, that means you're an ultra-Orthodox stone-throwing extremist, right? If you wear a knitted one, that means that you probably have Zionistic tendencies. If you wear a black leather one, that means you're frum but cool, right? So every yarmulke has a certain implication, right? Those are types of yarmulke. That's what people wear. It doesn't matter what you wear. As long as the truth of the matter is, you could wear a paper bag on your head, you could wear anything you want as long as you have your head covered. Obviously, you do not, there are certain times you don't have to wear a yarmulke, you do not have to have your head covered when you're sleeping, though according to the halacha, many people do sleep with their yarmulke on, right? Usually you wake up, the yarmulke is off, generally it falls right off the corner of the bed in the area farthest where you can't even reach it, you got to get off and crawl under. But there are many people who do try to sleep with their yarmulke. I try to sleep with my yarmulke on, and after you practice for a while, anyway, you do not have to wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, oh my goodness, my yarmulke is off. Right? You don't have to set your alarm for a yarmulke check. Right? In the middle of the night, you just have to go to sleep with the yarmulke and wake up, sleep normally. Obviously, when you're showering, you don't have to worry. When you're showering, when you're swimming, you do not have to wear a yarmulke. I was speaking to somebody yesterday about when you're back at home, what about the yarmulke? My experience was growing up in a religious society, I grew up wearing a knitted yarmulke. Right? Now, when we were wearing the yarmulke, very often, once in a while, not often, but once in a while, people make comments on the street, you're obviously Jewish. Other people are impressed by it. When I went to university, people saw the yarmulke. I remember somebody asking me if the different colors meant that I'm from a certain tribe, right? They knew something about tribes. And people were impressed that you're willing to make an external statement about your beliefs, right? If you feel that you're intimidated or you feel that you're in a dangerous neighborhood, if you're walking through a Ku Klux Klan rally, right, it's probably a good idea to take your yarmulke off, put on a baseball cap, right, or a sign that says, I love the Klan, whatever you do, right, put something on so that people don't see that you're obviously Jewish. If you're in the professional world, then you will find that the people in the professional world will respect you. I remember in university, also my tzitzis, I used to wear my tzitzis out, and even the tzitzis, everybody thought the tzitzis were so neat, right? The Jew strings. So the before you make, that's what they call them, the Jew strings, but before you make a commitment to it, realize that there are certain times where you should not parade around with the yarmulke. In those circumstances, in those situations, you can put on a cap. Wear a baseball cap, put on one of those, what are they called, a golf cap or some type of hat, anything you want, as long as you have your head covered, right?
Is there any halacha about a double head covering? Is there any reason for a black hat on top?
It mentions, it doesn't have to be a black hat, it could be any double head covering. For prayer, halacha says that a person should have it is ideal. It's not you're not obligated, and it's not a sin not to. It is ideal for a person to wear a double head covering when he davens as some type of form of respect. That is why married people pull the talus over their head when they daven. That's one of the reasons you got the yarmulke and the talus. And single people wear a hat in the Haredi community, the older Orthodox community. Single people wear a hat with their yarmulke on. That's the double covering that's mentioned in halacha. Okay, but I don't want to get too technical with it. Yeah.
Is it true that kippot, like the one that you're wearing, have a lining inside of them that would technically count as a double head covering?
I've heard that before, but I don't know that it's got the line. You know, I don't know if that counts. Most people I know who wear this yarmulke still wear a hat or a covering over it with that. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Now, the source of the Torah says like this. The Torah says, first of all, the first command in the Torah, this command to Adam and Chava, is be fruitful and multiply. That means God created a world, and God has a purpose for man in the world. The only way that man could achieve this purpose in the world is if there are more human beings, right? The more human beings there are, the more people there are that are available to serve God. One of the basic principles of Judaism is the reason everybody is created so differently, with different life circumstances, is that everybody has a separate individual task. And each person, as they fulfill their task, that increases God's glory. Each person has unique life circumstances. Some people have more difficult, some people are more wealthy, some people are suffering. Everybody with their personality and their unique life circumstances serves God. Our job is to bring as many people into the world as is possible in order that there can be that many more human beings that are able to serve God. So that's the first command of the Torah. First command of the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. There's a problem. If you're going to be fruitful and multiply, you have to have somebody to be fruitful and multiply with. And it's got to be done under proper circumstances. Therefore, there's a command later on in the Torah, in Deuteronomy, in Devarim, chapter 22, verse 13, that says, when a man takes a woman. Now, this is the Ki Yikach Ish Isha, when a man, this is the verse, the source for Torah marriage. Now, this is what we were talking about in the last shir, in the Gemara shir. There are three ways that a man could acquire a wife. The way it's done nowadays, right, a man could acquire a wife technically by Torah law, either through money. He gives her money and says, will you marry me? And she agrees through money. Nowadays, money is represented by the ring. The second way is a contract. He writes, with this contract, you are officially my wife. The third way is that they live together, done under proper circumstances in front of witnesses. They tell the witnesses, we are going to live together for the purpose of marriage, and then they go off alone together. By Torah law, all three of those are acceptable, and all three of those ways a woman becomes married to her husband. She's halakhically betrothed to her husband. I'm sorry. She's halakhically betrothed to her husband. However, nowadays it is prohibited to betroth a woman through living together. That is forbidden by rabbinic. There's a rabbinic injunction against that, and because of the fear that it could lead to immorality. Contract would be valid nowadays, except that it's not done. When your intended is standing under the chuppah with you, right, she wants a ring, she doesn't want a contract. Hi, babe, you're mine. And you hand her a contract, but she's not going to be happy, the photographer's not going to be happy, the bubby's not going to be happy, right? Everybody wants to see you put a ring on her finger. We'll see the significance of the ring in a little while. Now, how do you... Yeah?
Quick question about that first commandment. How do you counter an argument that the world is already far...
We'll get to that. I don't know if we're going to get there. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. That's going to be at the end. If you look at the syllabus, and the last section is going to talk about bringing children into the world, we'll discuss that at length. Okay? Now, first of all, how do you end up under the chuppah with somebody? So there is what's called, especially in a society which, as you've become aware, I'm sure is one of the first things that's investigated, is what is the social scene in the Orthodox community, right? In the Torah community, there is no social scene, right? There is no intermingling whatsoever, and to talk about it in an idealistic sense, there's no intermingling. Young men stay away from the women, and the women stay away from the men. There is no type of socializing. Any type of social interaction is only at the point that he is ready to get married. Right? Our belief is, and it's borne out by the rest of the world, that any type of intermingling eventually will lead, in most cases, many cases, or in some cases, to immorality, right? And therefore, since immorality is one of the cardinal sins of Judaism, we do everything we can to erect barriers to stop any type of intermingling. That's why you have the halachas that prohibit a young man not only from touching, right? A young man is not allowed to touch a young lady, but he's not a young man is not allowed to touch an old lady either. But we're talking about a young man is not allowed to touch a young man is not even allowed to be alone with a young lady behind a locked door or in a secluded area. You are not allowed to be alone. There's even a halakhic problem if you're on the bus late at night and the bus driver is on. There's you, a female, and the bus driver. For instance, there's a halakhic problem of you getting off the bus and leaving the two of them alone on the bus late at night. Right? There are certain, these are problems that come up in halakha. I take the question a little while. These are problems that come up in halakha all the time. Now, what happens is, write down the question. I'll take the question at the end of the section. What happens is, when a young man living in this society decides he wants to get married, or a young lady decides he wants to get married, so then we have what's called the arranged marriage. Now, the arranged marriage is not a forced marriage where they're told you are going to marry her. It is done through a form of introduction. The process is called a shidduch process. Now, the shidduch means bringing together, right? Two people are brought together. And our belief is, according to our tradition, when Adam was created as an androgynous being, right? God then split Adam and Eve. He split them up so that they can find each other. And in a perfect world, that means in the state of Adam before the sin, if all else, in a world where there would be no death, and where man would control nature, in that same perfect world, there would be perfect marriages. And you would always find your quote-unquote soulmate, right? Man would always end up with his soulmate, there would be no divorces, there would be perfect marriage. What happened was they sinned, and one of our jobs, in a form of suffering for some people, is that a person then has to go and find his zivug, find his spouse, his mate. Now, the Talmud says that before a man is created, 40 days before the embryo is formed, there's a heavenly voice that comes out and says, so-and-so will marry such-and-such, right? There's a divine decree that this individual, this young lady is a soulmate, the two of them are going to get married. It is entirely possible to miss your soulmate, right? And it does not mean that there is necessarily only one soulmate. I think Rabbi Taft will go into this at length. But the basic idea is that that soulmate could change at each level that you achieve. At each level, there may be a different soulmate waiting for you, right? So our goal, our belief is that when we do end up at the chuppah, we believe that we have ended up with the one who was predestined for us. But it is entirely possible for a person to be too picky and to end up in a situation where he has missed out on his soulmate. Now, who is it that can act as the shadchan? Who is it that the shadchan is? This person who matches people up. For the most part, anyone can be a shadchan. All you have to do is introduce two people, and you are a shadchan. There are people who do this for a living. And not only do it for a living, it is regarded halachically as being a very kosher form of money. Shadchan geld, what's called in Yiddish geld. Shadchan geld is considered very kosher money. There are people, there were great rabbis who used to buy their lulav and esrog. And sukkahs, they would buy their lulav and esrog with money that they earned through setting people up, because it's a tremendous mitzvah, so you're doing a kindness for two individuals. Second of all, the money that you make is considered very kosher money. Now, the one criteria the shadchan must fulfill, the shadchan must be responsible. It is not enough to say, you're a male, she's a female, I think it'd be wonderful. That's not good enough, because there are too many things that have to be investigated, the shadchan has to be responsible, there are too many things we'll see in a second. What the background is, where people believe they're going, what their goals are in life, so many factors that have to be taken into consideration. A shadchan must be responsible, and it is recommended that you do not approach somebody to set you up, anybody who is eventually going to be in a shidduch type situation, it is recommended you do not approach someone to set you up just because they're advertising they're a shadchan, right? You must find somebody who can be recommended the same way that you would go look for a doctor, only based on a recommendation, not based on a sign that says so-and-so is a doctor. Okay? Now, the system of shidduchim, obviously, somebody coming from our backgrounds, from a Western type of background, the shidduch system seems a little bit strange. How could two people who don't know each other, how could they be set up and then be expected to get married? So let me tell you, first of all, a couple of the benefits of the system. Number one, when a male decides it's time to get married, and the female decides it's time to get married, the people that they're meeting, anyone that they're meeting is with intent for matrimony. That means that you are spared a long, drawn-out relationship where in the end somebody may be disappointed, right? You can be dating somebody for a couple of years. One of the partners brings up the subject of marriage, and the other partner says, well, I have no intent to get married right now. I've got 6 years of schooling ahead of me before my next 6 years, right? I have no intent of getting married at this point. This system ensures that you are meeting people who are not dating for fun. They are dating because they've got a serious intent. That's benefit number one. Benefit number two, the females are protected, right? In a society where females are normally used and abused, this system guarantees that the female could go out safe with the knowledge that at no point is the guy she's seeing going to touch her, right? He is not going to touch her at all. If he does, he's blacklisted, right? He's blacklisted because obviously he's not playing by the rules of shidduchim. He's simply not at a level where he should be going out if that is what he's doing on the shidduch day, right? So I remember a guy at the yeshiva saying to me once that, I think I'd like to go out on a shidduch and try it and see what it's like. Now, you don't try it and see what it's like. You go out on a shidduch and you think that within 3 weeks you may be engaged, or within 2 months you may be engaged, or within 6 months you may be engaged. You do not go out on a shidduch, just say, well, what the heck, I've been around the yeshiva with a bunch of guys, I'm getting a little tired of this, let's call up a shidduch, let's see what's doing out there in the Beit. That's not what a shidduch is for. A shidduch is when you are ready, when you've decided, now it's time to get married, then you embark on a shidduch. Then you begin your shidduch career. Okay, so those are a couple of the benefits of the system. What's necessary when you go looking, people always say, I'd like to find my other half. Right. The first thing that's necessary is you must find the first half before you go looking for the other half. Right. Everybody's always worried about the other half. Right. Most of the time, we don't even know what we want in ourselves before we go. We must know what we want in ourselves. A person has to have clear goals, or at least clarity to a certain extent on where he's going in life. A few examples. You must know where you stand on religion. Right? Religion is very often a difficult topic when the views are not parallel to each other. Religion could be a big issue in marriage. Children, do you want children? How many children do you want? Money, do you plan on being a career person? Do you plan on studying Torah? What do you plan on doing? I'm talking about from a secular point of view. I'm only using these as examples from a secular point of view. When you're dating somebody secularly and you want to get married, these are certain things you better know before you get married. If you let's say you intend on never having children, and she intends on having lots of children, well, that could be a very big issue in a marriage, which could chas v'shalom end up in a divorce. In a shidduch, in a Torah society, obviously the children issue is not an issue, because it's prohibited to use birth control unless there are extenuating circumstances, and the assumption is anybody involved in the shidduch is committed to the Torah. We're talking about people who are Torah Jews, so anybody working in the system is committed to the system. We'll talk later, when we get to children, we'll talk about when those extenuating circumstances are. But for the most part, you still have to define what you're looking for in life in yourself. Do you want to live in Israel? Do you plan on studying Torah? Do you plan on working? What do you plan on doing? You could go out with a girl who is dead set on living in the United States, right? And then after 3 dates, you go out and you find out, well, she wants to live in the States. I never want to go back to the States, right? And that becomes a clash. That's the responsibility of a shadchan. A responsible shadchan will find out the basics. What are your goals? What are her goals? What do you want out of life? What does she want out of life? If that doesn't match, then she's not going to set, the shadchan will not set people up. If they're irresponsible, and we've seen lots of irresponsibility in shidduchim, then they will. But for the most part, they won't. I can tell you that in my particular shidduch, the shadchan, my wife at the point that when we met, before we met, my wife had told the shadchan that in no way does she want to live in Israel. Right? And I told the shadchan that I would very much want to live in Israel. And the shadchan said, you should go out anyway. Right, and then we worked it out one way or another at Forrester. But in general, the shadchan has to make sure you're taking a risk, but you're running a risk by having two people go out under those circumstances. You're running a risk. Now, what you're looking for in a young lady is somebody. You got to picture this as being the mother of your children. Right? Is this the model you want as the mother of your children? Is she considerate? Right? Is she One thing I can recommend for you, we're going to speak about this, I think the next class, the next one, is how does she, what comes out of her mouth, right? Is she always gossiping about people? She's always gossiping about people, and she's speaking Lashon Hara about people. That means if she's negative about people, chances are she's going to be negative about life. Right? To end up with a wife who sees the negative in everything, I can guarantee you it's going to be a living Gehenna, right? Because she creates the environment in the home. That's the power of the woman. She creates the environment in the home. She's going to make the home for you. And if she's negative on life, everything, little thing that goes wrong, she'll find it. If she's looking for negative in people, she'll find the negative in things. And therefore, that would be the worst type of person for you to marry, is somebody who is constantly gossiping, besides the fact that every word of Lashon Hara you speak, we mentioned every word of Torah is a mitzvah, every word of Lashon Hara is an avera. So a husband and wife can have a life, spend a lifetime, how was work today? Lousy. The boss is a jerk, and this guy's this, and this guy's this. How was your day? Lousy. That neighbor's a jerk. And the whole day is spent, their whole lifetime is replete with Lashon Hara. So it both tells you something about her quality of character, and it's a way to avoid a lifetime of avera. So you're looking for somebody who's considerate, you're looking for somebody who will be a role model as a mother. As far as physical looks, we're learning the Gemara right now, that the woman that you go out with, she does not have to be a stunning beauty, right? The woman simply has to be, according to halacha, she has to be at a level of physical beauty where she does not repulse you, right? It does not say anywhere that she has to be a stunning beauty. You have a right, obviously, to find a woman who is attractive. But one of the best ways to miss your soulmate is that when you go out with this young lady and she has blue eyes and you were dead set on brown eyes, right, and you reject her and say, sorry, right, this is not what, this, right, you pull out the book and no, this wasn't it, sorry, right, next, right? That's the fastest way to miss your soulmate, is by being a little too picky. If there is something about her that absolutely turns you off, then you have a halakhic obligation not to marry her, right? If you see her and she turns you off, then obviously that's not the one you should marry. There has to be some type of attraction where there will be a potential for love to develop. That means that obviously at the outset there is no love, because love, according to our definition of love, love is a result of constant giving. In the Western society, love means taking, right? The same person that looks at his girlfriend and says, Edna, I love you, right, that same guy sits down to a meal and he says, I love ice cream, right? So now Edna and ice cream are on the same level, right? What does it mean when somebody sits down and he says, I love ice cream, right? If you love ice cream, or I love fish. If you love fish, why are you biting it, right? If you love fish, why are you chewing it, right? Love, by that definition, what does it mean when you say you love ice cream? When you say you love ice cream, it means I love myself and I love ice cream because it gives me pleasure. Selfish love is the type of love where people fall in love, like falling into a big pit, right? People fall in love, and then you end up with a selfish relationship because your view of the other person is what this person can do for me, and very often that ends up in disaster. Our attitude of love is that when you love somebody, you give to them. By giving to somebody else, you see yourself in that other person. You've invested your energy. If there's one person in the world you love, who's the one person you really love? Yourself, right? We are all very fond of ourselves, right? We can look around a room full of people. Yep. I love me more than I love any of you, no question about it. And I've got all sorts of qualities which I can see in me, which I can't see. You, I see all of your flaws, right? By myself, flawless. I've been flawless since the day I've been born. Every single individual thinks that way. Right, we see by ourselves. The Gemara says a person sees everybody else's flaws except his own. That's what the Talmud says. Everybody can see. You can hear a musser. You can hear a musser lesson where somebody gets up and says you shouldn't be selfish and you should overcome selfishness. And you sit there at the lesson thinking, yep, that guy's pretty selfish over there. And you think of everybody in the world. Oh, my brother ought to hear this talk, right? Because my brother is really, right. We never think of it in the light of ourselves, right? The true definition of love. Is what develops after constant giving. You know that's why in the mother-child relationship, which is a stronger bond, the mother-child or the father-child? No bond like the mother-child relationship. A parent has a stronger bond with the child than a child does with the parent, because the parent is constantly giving to the child. The parent invests energy in the child. A child gives to parents but in a very unintentional way. Right? When you see your little two-year-old toddler and he burps loudly and everybody cheers, that's so cute. He gives you pleasure. That's unintentional pleasure. He has not invested energy in that. A parent, or when a child speaks for the first time, or a child takes the first steps, parents have tremendous joy from such a thing. But the child's not investing in the parent. A parent invests in a child, and who invests the most in a child?
Mother.
The mother invests from the moment of conception. Pregnancy is difficult, giving birth is even more difficult, and the mother has a relationship with the child where the child's been carried inside of her, right? We believe women are internal. You'll notice everything about them, their physiology is internal. She carries the child internally. We believe emotionally she internalizes more than men do for that reason. She's inside the home. Everything about the woman's nature dictates, and we believe, according to our tradition, is internal. Kol kuda bas melech pnima. The honor of the Jewish daughter is inward. She is supposed to be inside. She's the minister of the interior. The husband is the foreign minister. It's a partnership. The husband is outside the home. She runs the home. I know a guy who was writing out an application, and the woman behind the desk asked him if he worked. He said, yes. Like, what do you do? I'm an engineer. What about your wife? Does she work? Yes. Well, what does she do? Well, she's a psychologist. And she's a nurse. Wow, well, very impressive, right? And she's a judge. No kidding, and she's a policeman. Really? Right? He went through a whole list. She's a housewife, right? She has to do all these things, and she's got to do them well, right? She's got to mete out justice, and she's got to cook. She's a chef, so on and so forth. We believe that there are two very important roles, and the roles are divided up. Now, the love that will come in a marriage will come after the marriage has been going on for a long time. The goal is to find somebody who you can potentially shower your giving at. Right? There are going to be problems after. I know somebody once went to his rabbi right before he got married. He said to the rabbi, "Rabbi, I'm about to get married. Give me a blessing." So the rabbi said to him, "I bless you that you should have many good fights with your wife." So he said to the rabbi, "Oh, what kind of blessing is that?" So the rabbi said, "Look, you can have a lot of fights anyway. You may as well have them with a blessing." Right? The HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we'll talk about that in a second. One of the reasons why that is so. The meeting. Right? The meeting, right? The moment we've all been waiting for. What happens at the meeting? The meeting is no different than when you've met somebody at a party. Right? The meeting is a male meeting a female. Obviously, there's that natural, what God created, the natural excitement between a male and a female. You're nervous, she's there, everybody's nervous, right? And you meet each other. Now, the first thing you're looking for, obviously, is no different than anything you've been looking for in a serious relationship. We're talking about when you've been involved in a serious emotional relationship. You're looking for compatibility. You're looking for somebody who understands you. You're looking for somebody who will listen to you and somebody who you will listen to and you will understand. You can speak to each other. If when you meet, the first thing you say is hi, you ask her name, and she says, she asks you your name, and then you sit there for 10 minutes without anything to say, right? You know that you're on the wrong track, right? If the first thing that happens is you take a look at her, and I'm saying this in all seriousness, take a look at her and you're repulsed, right? You know that you're not going anywhere, right? That's not going to say. You may take a look at her, and you'll find that you're not particularly like, wow, you know, you're not stunned, but that'll change. If you truly like the person, and you've all experienced it, that'll change, because the beauty very often is only skin deep. I'm sure there have been plenty of people in your life that you've met, somebody who you couldn't wait to meet, and you finally walk up to her and say, hi, what's your name? Oh, oh my goodness, right, and you're out the door. Right, because that, and all of a sudden that beauty, right, what looked to you was so attractive, all of a sudden that beauty's gone, right, that beauty is so shallow. So the first thing there must be compatibility. Now, there's no time limit, at the meeting, and there's no time limit in the amount of meetings that you have. You're allowed to meet somebody, that you can have a meeting. Generally, the first meeting runs for a couple hours. If you know right away that you're not going to marry this person, you still have an obligation to be a gentleman. Right, you have an obligation to. You're talking to a human being over here. You cannot look at her and say, "Oh, wow." There's obviously, you know, some guys show up at some guy. You know, a guy walks into the meeting, right? You know, Yanko walks into the meeting, right? He's supposed to meet this girl. This girl looks at him and says, "Hi, are you Yanko?" They meet at hotels. Very few people meet at hotels, right? So they're waiting. Somebody's waiting in the lobby, right? Yankel walks in, and the girl comes up to him and says, "Hi, are you Yankel?" He takes one look and says, "No, Yankel couldn't make it tonight. I'm his friend. Sorry." Right? Obviously not appropriate. Obviously not appropriate. And if you're at a meeting and you find that this person is not somebody who you're going to marry, you still have every obligation to treat her as a human being. And afterwards, you report the shadchan. We'll ask you, how did it go? Are you interested in another meeting? And any other questions? If you are interested in another meeting, you tell the shadchan. The shadchan will then tell the girl, right? The girl will get back to the shadchan. She'll let the shadchan know whether or not she's interested. If you're interested, then you go out again. As you keep going out, then you decide on your own how many times it takes you until, if you see that at a certain point you're compatible, you've got similar life goals, you've discussed certain crucial issues. There's certainly going to be certain things that you disagree on. After marriage, there could be a lot more things you disagree on, but before marriage, there are certain crucial issues. It's not even as much the issues as how she answers. I found that it wasn't what she said as much as how she answered. So I had certain crucial issues. The Lashon Hara thing was one very big issue by me. And I remember asking my wife, you know, what does she think about Lashon Hara? She said she loves the Chafetz Chaim, right? Anybody knows anything about Lashon Hara? So I figured, how bad could she be, right? But I wasn't going to marry her based on that, right? But to me, that was a crucial issue. Very often, it's how she answers the questions as opposed to what the answers are, right? So if you find that you're compatible, at a certain point, you are allowed to get engaged. Very often, the Shadchan will let you know, right, that at a certain point in time she is waiting to be proposed to. Right? For those of you that are spineless, at a certain point the shadow will say she is waiting. You can pop the question at any